British Prime Minister David Cameron appeared before the Leveson inquiry into the ethics of the British press, sparked, of course, by the phone hacking scandal, where reporters and investigators snooped on the phone messages of celebrities and even me. While he was there, though, David Cameron's government was unveiling plans to snoop on absolutely everybody's email, Twitter, Facebook, and other internet use, handing a blank check to internet and phone firms to pay for it all. Cameron has clearly had an irony bypass. Back from the dead, Dallas, the US soap which ended in 1991, is being revived. If you're old enough to remember, you will know that it was about the warring Ewing family, where the blood may be thicker than water, but oil is thicker than both. And these two women, according to the French press, could be auditioning for parts in Dallas. They are the former and present lovers of new French President François Hollande, and their war has totally overshadowed today's second round of the French elections. Nothing, though, can overshadow the next half hour, because this is the real deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. I'm George Galloway, and I'm here every week in London bringing you the news and views you just won't find in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, as always. But if you wanted to fire back at me, you could, at least by email, at the address showing on the screen. In the Eurozone, Spain was bailed out during the week at a cost of 100 billion euros. That's around 80 billion pounds and getting on for $125 billion, and it won't be the last, mark my words. It's impossible to speak a sentence about the Eurozone without the words crisis and bailout in it. Greece goes to the polls today, and if the left-wing coalition wins, then that will be next week's crisis in the Eurozone. If there is a solution to this, then I suppose it's having a centralised economy run from Germany. Where else? In which case, why did we bother fighting the Second World War? But would the EU member states wear that? My studio guests certainly wouldn't. The Leveson inquiry into phone hacking in the British press grinds on. Oh, grinds on. And former Prime Minister Gordon Brown gave evidence. And on Thursday, the present Prime Minister, David Cameron, gave his take. Not that he really gave or took very much. It was pretty bland stuff. The bulk of his time was taken up by inquiries about his relationship with the Murdoch press, with former chief executive of the same, Rebecca Brooks, who's now facing criminal charges, and why he hired former News of the World editor Andy Coulson as his chief spin doctor, he who is also now facing perjury charges. What also impinged was the issue of the culture secretary, Jeremy Hunt, the man who was to judge whether Murdoch's News Corporation could take over the bit of the broadcaster B Sky B that it didn't already own. The Labour opposition tried to bring down Hunt over his handling of it. Their motion occasioned a debate about whether Hunt had lied to Parliament. But despite the Conservatives' coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, abstaining, and with the help of one MP forced to miss a funeral and another dragged back from his honeymoon, the Labour motion was defeated. Hunt has been in the media spotlight for weeks, and he's never been seen without that smirk, yes, that one, on his face. It's a gravity-defying permagrin, probably held in place by super glue, safety pins, or maybe a Botox overdose. I must get up close and personal to see. He'll keep sniggering, no doubt, all the way to his inevitable knighthood, however, because he isn't being sacked so far. Leveson is about media snooping, but this present British government are the daddies of that. Or rather, big brothers. Britain already has more CCTV cameras per square inch than any other country in the world. And now Cameron and co. are about to launch their very own snooper's charter. Under proposed legislation, the government will give a blank check to internet and phone firms to pay for them tracking everyone's email, Twitter, Facebook, and other internet usage. It's going to cost hundreds of millions of pounds for a massive invasion of people's privacy, along with breaching the civil rights of almost every citizen in the country, and presumably anyone from abroad who communicates with them. It's supposed to catch terrorists before they terrorize. That's, of course, the excuse. The police and the security services already make 500,000 requests a year in Britain for communications data. To put this in context, that's more than 6 times the number of similar inquiries the FBI makes in the United States. And this figure is sure to rise exponentially, as is the cost. Now, I mentioned Dallas in the introduction. It was the long-running soap opera which ended in 1991 and had more backstabbings and double dealings than the British Parliament. The Ewing family returns. Some old, like the villain JR, seen here. Some completely changed, reincarnated by new actors who weren't even alive when the original series ended. This new Dallas is a cable show and, in high definition, slotted as a summer filler in the schedules. It's expensive to make, but not as expensive as the new deal in the English Premier League, which will cost TV companies £6.6 million for every match screened. And if you've seen some of the matches they screen, you'll realise that's a lot of money. You could make a couple of art house movies for that. But I mentioned Dallas, frankly, cheaply, just to segue into the French equivalent. It's the fight which is overshadowing today's second round of the French elections, where the socialists are expected to triumph. The fight is between President Hollande's partner, Valérie Trier-Wheeler, and his ex-partner, Ségolène Royal. The president is sandwiched in a kind of psychodrama between two jealous women from his present and his past. Royal, Hollande's partner for 30 years and the mother of his 4 children, is running as an MP in La Rochelle, a very nice place. Local socialist Olivier Falorni, however, is standing against her because he claims she was parachuted in over his head. But in a tweet, Hollande's now partner took Falorni's side against Royal. Très embarrassing. Given that Holland is personally supporting Royal, of course, and his endorsement appears on her campaign literature. This row between the two women may dent the socialist fortunes in the election today. Instead of asking whether the new French president can get to grips with the euro crisis, commentators and opposition politicians are asking whether he can handle his personal relationships. JR, he ain't. He would have sorted it out. Still in Europe. But my studio guest, I hazard, wants us out of it. He's Robert Ouldes, director of the Bruges Group, which sounds very European, but I'd have to describe him as the head of a neoliberal think tank which is against European integration and wants Britain out of the EU. I always characterise such people as red-faced, bucolic Englishmen standing at the Channel Port shouting boo at Johnny Foreigner, but Robert's a much more civilised guy than that. Robert, welcome to The Real Deal. Joking aside, you must be really happy at the state the Eurozone's in. No?
Well, it's actually really alarming. It's causing a great deal of harm across many different countries. Greece has been suffering as a result of policies coming from the EU, particularly the European Central Bank. Now Spain is suffering. We've already seen the pain in Italy and, of course, Ireland and Portugal. And it's the ordinary people that are hurting. It's actually really alarming. It is something I predicted many years ago, but real people are losing their jobs. People are losing their livelihoods and their futures as a result of the EU and its wrong-headed push to centralise power in the institutions of the EU in Brussels.
But it's a price worth paying from your point of view, isn't it? Because it's wrecking the thing that you see as the demon.
Well, the European Union is using it as a beneficial crisis in one sense to push for more centralisation. It's creating harm, but it's not hurting the political elite that have established this project. It's there to help the important people within the European Union, but not the ordinary people who are working or trying to find work. It's hurting ordinary people, and political power is still being passed to the EU. It's still trying to centralise. It's trying to take greater control over people's lives to the institutions of the EU, away from democratically elected people and away from democratic institutions.
Summarise for our international audience just what the Bruges Group's principal opposition to the euro and the eurozone and the broader European Union project as we know it, what's that based on? What's your central critique?
The principal thing is that the EU is undemocratic, or not even sort of, in one sense, it's more than undemocratic, it's anti-democratic. It's a supranational system of governance which seeks to bind what member states do. The European Union is a collection of different member states that are being governed by the institutions of the European Union that are based in Brussels. And that can create legislation, it can pass laws, it can dictate economic policy. And that's what it means is that power has passed away from national parliaments, where people can elect governments and dismiss governments and have more influence over the laws which affect their lives, to institutions which are, in a sense, unaccountable and often favour various vested interests, sometimes the interests of big business, as opposed to ordinary working people, or, of course, small and medium-sized enterprises.
And do you think the European Union has brought any good?
No, I do not. It hasn't created any jobs. The European Union is suffering economically. We see unemployment rising massively in countries such as Greece, where unemployment is now past 22%. Youth unemployment in Spain is past 54%. It is creating economic harm. The euro does actually benefit Germany and helps Germany export to other Eurozone countries, but everybody else, pretty much apart from the Dutch and the Finns and the Germans, are hurting economically. The European Union is not a benefit of ordinary people, whether that's small and medium-sized enterprises, ordinary working people, or, of course, pensioners. It's about a political elite and a centralisation of power.
Well, what about the fact that in the lifetime of some of the people watching this, 100 million Europeans lay dead, having killed each other in a European, largely European, world war? There's been no war since there was a European Union. There is amity, by and large, between the nations of the European Union that were formerly bitter enemies. That's a benefit, surely. I expected you, even you, to acknowledge that one.
Well, the European Union is creating disharmony. We see people in Greece who are fed up of being dictated to by Germany, and they're remembering the war, they're remembering the occupation of their country by the Germans, and they're feeling very, very vulnerable about their future, and they're feeling that they're being dictated to again. So it's creating discord where it's meant to be creating harmony. And really, we need to recognise that the European Union hasn't prevented any wars within Europe, because the centralisation of the EU really did begin in earnest in the 1980s. And the problem with the Second World War wasn't caused through national governments, it was caused through undemocratic people who were not elected and were authoritarian, that weren't responsive to their people's needs. Really, if we want peace, then we should have democratic nation states, and that way we wouldn't have wars within Europe. And that's what came out of the Second World War, was democratic nation states who were mostly peaceable. But of course, with the European Union, power has been centralised away from those democratic nation states. So what would the future be for Europe if power is passed away from people who are elected to people who you can't elect, that are unaccountable? Then the only way will be to go to the streets to try and get grievances resolved.
Three times you mentioned the Germans. Do you have a particular problem with the Germans? If Britain were the dominant economic power in Europe, would that be easier to bear for you?
Well, it wouldn't be right for Britain to be dictating to other countries how they should be running their economy.
Heaven forfend.
But Germany is
doing so. We only did so for 200 years. Go
but
on.
But it's not anti-German to say that Chancellor Merkel dictating to Spain and Greece that they should follow a different economic policy. That's not anti-German. It's to say, look, the Greeks and the Spanish people, they want things done differently. And austerity might have worked for Germany. Can't say it's particularly working in the UK. It's certainly not working in Italy, Greece, Ireland, Portugal and Spain, where those countries are in a deep, deep recession.
Well, I'm certainly with you on that line of argument. But here's where we'd part company. If the European Union was a democratic European Union, rather than, as you characterise it, and correctly, as a plutocratic one, as a European Union of elites. But if it were democratic, I think that would be a good thing. You still think it would be a bad thing?
Well, Europe is a very diverse continent, and what is right for Germany is wrong for possibly for Spain. And we're actually seeing that in action. And the future of Europe cannot be the greater centralisation, even if it were democratic. That would mean that there would be some bloc that would be dictating to other people how their countries should be run. What would be better is a diverse Europe running their own economies as they see fit, trying their own policies. That would be better, and learning from each other rather than a monolithic structure. And if there were to be a federal Europe with political power that was even more centralised and control over fiscal policy as well as monetary policy and tax and spend policy being controlled from the centre, that would mean there would be less diversity in Europe, and that would be, I think, a bad thing.
But the world that we're in and about to enter has two gigantic poles within it. The United States of America seems to run pretty well. And what's good for Michigan is not the same as what's good for California. But they have a single currency. They have a federal state. And it seems to work. China is as diverse as can be and is 1.5 billion people, but run from a center, Beijing. And that's doing pretty well too. Aren't you whistling in the wind, looking for a return to the days when small nation states, which are much less than the disaggregation of their parts, were able to flourish in the world?
Well, the smaller nation states in Europe are actually a lot better off. Countries such as Norway, Iceland, Switzerland, they have a far better standard of living. Their democracy.
Iceland?
Iceland,
it was,
yes.
It was bankrupt and covered in ash the last time I looked.
It did go bankrupt. It lost a great deal of money, but it took the decision to default on its debts because it was not beholden to any supranational government. It was not beholden to Brussels. They said, we can't afford to pay this money back. And since then, the Icelandic economy has recovered. And they show a brilliant example. If Greece would only just admit, we cannot afford these debts, we cannot afford to pay this money to French and German financial institutions, banks that have recklessly lent us money, we can't afford it. If they were to default fully, get out of the euro, have their own currency, their economy would start to grow. And now Iceland is a far bigger recipient of foreign direct investment in their country than we are in Britain per capita and in every other eurozone state apart from Germany.
Does the Bruges Group advocate countries defaulting on their debts?
Well, it is the only answer for Greece and for Spain. We see the bailout that's been given to Spain. That's not actually to help the Spanish people. That money is being given to the Spanish government, which then has to be given to the Spanish banks, which then has to be transferred back to the French, mainly French and German banks that have lent them money. Now, that doesn't actually mean that the ordinary Spanish people benefit. No. In fact, it'll actually hurt them because the money just passes out of the country directly. And it just adds to the Spanish government's debts. They're now 100 billion deeper into debt when they're already a highly indebted nation. And that just means that they've got more money to pay back. And of course, the costs now fall directly on the Spanish taxpayer, the few Spanish people that are left in work. And of course, it makes it even harder for them to borrow money in the future, raising their borrowing costs. So the bailouts that have been given don't actually benefit ordinary people. They continue the money flow within the European Union to various banks that have political influence over the European Union, but they don't actually help ordinary people.
And are you sometimes to be found with your Union Jack waistcoat down at the Channel ports shouting boo at Johnny Foreigner?
Well, I think Britain's usually been a global nation, and we should be looking outside of the European Union, forging alliances with other countries around the world rather than being stuck inside the European Union, which is a declining bloc. It's declining economically because power has been centralised, and that means that economic decisions aren't taken for the benefit of the people. They're taken for the benefit often of big business and sometimes big financial institutions.
Well, I must say you make a good case, Robert Olds of the Bruges Group. Thanks very much indeed for that. But stay tuned. It's Fighting Talk next. Now, this is where I aim blows at someone or something, which has particularly irked me. I had a very big choice in front of me this week, but I chose the London Olympics, which is almost, of course, upon us. During the week, we got a glimpse of the opening ceremony when film director Danny Boyle, who made Slumdog Millionaire, unveiled his vision of it, replete with pastoral scenes, cows, and quaint English coves. He's obviously never been in East London, which is where the Olympics are taking place. I'm against them. I said, can we not give them back? We actually bid for those Olympics when Britain was having its 10 richest years in its history, but we are getting them when we are on the verge of national bankruptcy. And the money that's being spent on the Olympic Games, between 15 and 20 billion pounds, I'll warrant, by the end of it all, we simply don't have. We're adding to our national debt. Pensioners and unemployed people and students and children and health service patients are all having their services cut to pay for a jamboree involving synchronized swimming and all these horsey pastimes with men in hats and waistcoats jumping over gates. Because, of course, the truth is, the vast majority of British people have absolutely no interest at all in the vast majority of the so-called sports in the Olympic Games, like lifting very, very heavy weights and not dropping them. Why should the British taxpayer be paying for the weightlifters of Outer Mongolia to come and entertain a very, very small number of people? And then there's the security. East London has been turned into an armed camp. They're putting missiles on the roofs of blocks of flats in the East London constituency that I used to represent in Parliament. We have made ourselves one of the most hated countries in the world over the last 15 years. We're the last people on earth who should be holding such a big target for the terrorists out there who will want to hurt us. So, it's too expensive, it's too boring. Apart from the 100 metres dash and the mile, as we used to call it, the 1500 metres, I can't think of anything in the British Olympic Games that I'm going to watch, except the bank statement that comes in to the country when it's all over. Because I've been in many countries, in Montreal and many other places, where I've seen the white elephants that are left after the games have come and gone. As they crumble and decay, they are a permanent reminder of the huge expense that was unnecessarily gone into by the country which bid for and got the Olympic Games. Next week, God willing, I'll be back.